So the goal is that you'll know everything on how to paskin Hilchos Ribbis within the next hour or so. I think it's a pretty reasonable approach. I'll just start with Divrei Hakdama. Ribbis is a very tricky area. Therefore, really, no one should ever try to paskin one of these on their own without a more formal learning. One of the well-respected Rosh Yeshiva poskim of our yeshiva came over to me the day and said, "You know why I don't know Hilchos Ribbis?" Which is kind of a trick question, you know. He said, because Hilchos Ribbis, you really need far more than the halacha. A person has to understand business. If you don't understand business, you're probably unlikely you're going to get the answers right. It's a little bit like trying to paskin a shlita shaila, having never seen a cow. It's just not going to really work all that well. All the Shulchan Aruch is not going to prepare you for it. Hilchos Ribbis appears in many different flavors. The first flavor, which is the flavor that we know and love, which is really the most awesome, is what's called Ribbis Katsutza. Ribbis Katsutza is another saying of Ribbis D'oraisa. That's a typical case. I say, I'm giving you $10, I want $11 back. Right? Meaning that we're dealing with cash, we're dealing with a specific interest rate, and in the event that I give you the $10, you give me the $11 back, that is a violation of Ribbis D'oraisa. According to the halacha, Ribbis D'oraisa is Yotze B'dayanim, meaning that I can take you to, you can take me to Beis Din in our case, and you could say, okay, I gave this person an extra dollar in Ribbis, I would like it back, the Beis Din will actually paskin and force you to give the money back. That only applies in Ribbis Katsutza. Right? When we talk about other forms of Ribbis, like Ribbis, what they call Avak Ribbis, or the like, there are three or four levels of Ribbis, depending on how you slice it. If anybody takes a look at the sheets which were sent out, there's a Chai Adam someplace here. If I remember correctly, it would be number 10, which spells out the different types of Ribbis and the nafkaminas between the different types of Ribbis. So in the event that it's Ribbis D'Rabbanan, which could come in many forms and sizes, things change at that point. And one of the major things that changes is that it's not Yotze B'Dayanim. In the event that we have Ribbis D'Rabbanan, and I go and take you to court over it, and I say I like my Ribbis back, I'm not entitled to collecting that money. Min HaShemayim, I should pay it back. But Mid HaOraisa, the Basin does not give it back. It's interesting. Ribbis is part of a very large percentage of cases that come to Beis Din. So, for example, almost every contract has late payment. It has interest fees if you don't pay on time, etc., etc. To what extent will we enforce that? So that has to do with many issues. By and large, Avak Ribbis, even though it's not Yotze B'Dayanim, for sure Beis Din would never give it to you. I mean, that Min HaShemayim, you shouldn't be taking it, of course you're not going to be able to collect it. When it comes to Ribbis, Ribbis does not just apply to the Malveh and the Malobeh, but according to the Gemara tells us it applies to everybody involved. In the event that there are Edim, who witnessed the transaction, they as well would be over the Issur Ribbis. The Sofer, right? The Sofer nowadays is the lawyer, right? If I'm coming with a complex business transaction, inevitably the contract is going to be written by a lawyer. A lawyer is over an Issur Ribbis for writing a contract between two Jewish parties. Even if they're not religious and they don't really care about it, that doesn't matter. You're still over an Issur Ribbis by writing that contract. It's not just a matter of Lifnei Iver. Yes, that's involved as well, but there's an actual Issur Ribbis involved in doing something like that.
Why is that? Why is Ribbis so important? Why is the Edom more than the Sefer?
No, both.
Why?
It's the Fair Shigamar Gemara has a drush on it. I imagine I probably even put it on the sheet. Look at number 3 on the sheet. Gemara in Bava Metzia, Ayin Hamad Beis. Ve'elu Avim Belosa Say Hamal Ve'Lover Ve'Ha'Ore Ve'Edim Ve'Chamim Afa Sofer. Fair Shigamara. There is no negotiation on this one. Now, later, the Mefarshim Al Shas and the Shulchan Aruch point out that those Isurim only apply if you're dealing with Ribbis Katsutza. This is another nafkamina. If you're dealing with Ribbis that's Nidurabanan, or even perhaps less than that, then the Issur is only on the Malveh and the Loveh, it's not on anybody else. So again, that's another time you have to be very careful with understanding when Ribbis is the Raisa, and when Ribbis is the Rabbanan has many wide-reaching ramifications. Now, as a little bit of a hadama to the rules of Ribbis, so in the event I was going to open up a Shulchan Aruch and look for Hilchos Ribbis, I would have expected to find it in Chelek, Choshen Mishpat, with all the other halachas related to money, right? Just like I'm going to find Hilchos Geneva, then I'm going to find Edus, I'm going to find Dayanim, I'm going to find Shutvim, I'm going to find Diskei Shechinim, I'm going to find whatever other monetary issues, right? I'm going to find my Kinyanim there, right? I would expect that just like I have Geneva there, I should also have Ribbis there. In fact, if a person really wants to find Hilchos Ribbis, they have to look into Yeridaya. So the question comes up, how was Ribbis accidentally put in the wrong chelek? Shouldn't it have been put in Choshen Mishpat? So the person who decided what goes into which chelek is?
The Tor.
The Tor. Right, so you're going to look in the Tor and see what the Tor says about this. The Tor explains that he put it in Yeridaya for a very specific reason. The reason he put it into Yeridaya was that a person should understand this is not like any other type of halacha. Typically, anything that you're going to find in Choshen Mishpat, you can undo through Mechila. If you rob my car, and I am Mochel, it's all better. Right? If you burn down my haystack, and I'm Mochel, it's all better. I can always give him Matana. Right? I can always give it back to you, I can always get around it. Right? So therefore, anything you're going to find in Choshen Mishpat is only a problem because I'm Makbid. This is mine, I don't want you to have it. However, in the event that there is something out there which I don't care, automatically, despite what everybody said in the Halacha Yomis for the last week or so, automatically, Mechila gets you out of anything in Choshen Mishpat. Hilchos Ribbis, by definition, are dealing with Mechila. When I enter an agreement and I agree to pay you Ribbis, under normal business circumstances, I think you're doing me a favor. So, I need a loan. I want to start a business, right? You loan me $50,000. I think I'm going to make $1 million over it. You only want $55,000 back. Boy, that's great. You're willing to take the risk. Thank you very much. Right? I need to pay the bills, whatever. I got to send my kid to college. I need money. You give me the money. I am grateful for it. Every single case in Ribbis involves Mechila. If it wasn't, there wasn't Mechila involved, we wouldn't even have the case here. So that's what the Torah is saying, and he actually says he's saying it. I put it on the sheets. The Torah says very clearly that the reason that Hilchos Ribbis appears in Yeridaya is because it's not a Choshen Mishpat type of thing. It's not a Bein Odom L'Chavero where I have a right to be Mochalit. But rather, Ribbis has been on a lamako. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells you you're not allowed to charge Ribbis, and the fact that the other guy doesn't mind doesn't make a huge have a difference. So that's the basics of Ribbis. Ribbis is a very specific Choshen Mishpat, not rule, a Yeridaya rule, where in fact HaKadosh Baruch Hu is setting the rules here, and even though logically it may or may not make sense, you just possibly cannot take the Ribbis. The fact that I'm giving you a great deal, that the going rate is 7%, that I'm giving you 2%. Right? There's logic behind it. If you need money, right, because you need to buy food, I understand I should give that to you interest free. But you need money because you're opening up an internet cafe. Right? You're opening up a coffee bean someplace or another. Right? So you're going to take this money, you're having my money in order to make money. Had I not given you the money, I could have put it in the bank and gotten 0.03%. I'm losing by not giving it to you. Just to ask you to make me whole would seem logically to make sense. Rather, that's not the din. The din is that all, whatever the use is for, you cannot charge Ribbis. The guy can be mochel from today till tomorrow. The guy can be the happiest person in the world to pay Ribbis. That's not going to make a difference. So therefore, a person has to be very careful. I'll give an example. So, an old classmate of mine, he's got a few years on me, Rabbi Shaya Greenwald, who some of you may know, he's a Rebbe in Israel right now. When Rabbi Greenwald first made Aliyah, so I went to visit him in Israel, I went to his apartment, he was living in Harnof at the time, and I said to him, "Nu, what can you tell me about making Aliyah?" He said, "The entire Eretz Yisrael is one big Ribbis Shiloh." He said, "There are far too many Jews here. Everything's a Ribbis Shiloh." So he gave me the following example. He says, when you make Aliyah, you get certain zechuyot. So among the zechuyot you get is you get interest-free loans. And they give you money, no interest. And he said, Mamish, no interest. They said, no interest. So he said, what if I decide to move back to America? So he said, that's nothing. So we charge you 2-3%. So even though that would make it, that's what's called Sad Echad Ribis. That there's a possibility in this transaction that this could potentially become a Ribis transaction, that is problematic, Midrabbanan. So therefore, a person has to be very careful. Well, Ribis can appear just about anywhere. Right? The basic translation of Ribis is called Schar Hamtanas Malus. Schar Hamtanas Malus means that I am paying you for holding onto your money for an additional period of time. Right? I am renting money. That would be the best definition of Ribis. Anything else can be rented. Okay, so for example, in Hebrew, we have two different words. One's called Schirus, and the other's called Halva. How do you translate Schirus? Right? To rent something, right? What's Halva? To borrow. What's the difference between borrowing and renting? What? So if I go to the bank and I borrow money, would you call that renting in English? No. Right? Really, that you might think the difference is whether you pay or not, but it doesn't, because in English, right, borrowing is really the same thing. Whether I borrow money or I borrow your car, that's the same thing. When it comes to Hebrew, halva means to borrow money, as opposed to anything else, right, to be shoel, for example, would mean to borrow anything but money. And there's a big difference. If I borrow anything but money, I can pay interest for that. I can pay for having it. If I'd like to borrow your car, right? People come to the base measures. Once a year I get the shuttle for sure. Guy's going on a date, he borrows a guy's car, and now he wants to return it with a full tank of gas. When I borrowed it was 3/4 full, and now I think I might have put in more gas than he had beforehand. What do I do about that? This is a standard once a year shiloh. The answer is you say thank you. There's nothing wrong with paying extra to borrow the guy's car. There's no ribis involved. It's no matter I borrowed the car to return the same car. No. You have a right to rent the car. And if that's the case, I can pay you. I can give you a gift for doing it. And if that gift is a full tank of gas, that's fine. In fact, when I lend out my car, I tell guys I expect it back with a full tank of gas no matter what you're taking it with. If they record, are they now a shomer sachar versus a shomer chinam? Please don't rent the car. But the bottom line is that when it comes to anything else, you have a right to charge interest with it. I remember I was once in a job interview in a previous life, and at this interview, you know, the guy was interviewing 10 people, and I was the first interview of the day, and the guy got very nervous. So, what are you so nervous about? He said, this is embarrassing. I'm doing interviews. It's really 50 minutes each. I didn't bring a watch. So I said, here, take my watch. He said, how's he a firm guy? He said, I can't do that. So why not? What are you going to do? You're going to sit here, you're going to just be poking at the guys like you're doing to me right now. Take my watch. I trust you. When you're done, I know where you live. If not, just mail it to me. So this was for a publishing company. So the guy sent it back, and he sent back some books with it to say thank you. Ribis? No, he rented my watch. That's what it's called. You're allowed to rent anything, but you can't rent money. I can't pay you for holding your money for any period of time. Now, that can come in two different flavors, really. Right? Oftentimes, so we recently got a bill at home. It was a doctor's bill. It was from a hospital. And it said that you have to pay X amount of dollars. And if you pay within 30 days, you get a 3% discount. Which is the reverse of you have to pay your Con Ed bill on time. If you miss the deadline, it's 1.5% fee. The Gemara says both of those are very problematic. If I owe you money in 30 days from now, and you tell me if you give it to me now, you can have it for less, that is Schar Hamtanos Malos. How does that work? So again, I don't have to give you the money for the next 30 days. Right? So therefore, I own this money now. You want to borrow the money for a certain amount of time. You like the money now, 30 days earlier, and you're willing to pay for it. So I'm, in effect, lending you the money, and you're paying for it. Similarly, it's not different than you owe me the money a day that I owe you the money on this day, but if I pay late, I'm going to have to pay for the right of holding on to the money. So this tends to be very tricky, because in both of those cases, so what are you supposed to do? So obviously in the Con Ed case, it's relatively easy. In the Con Ed case, you obviously, the real time it's due is now, and if I miss it, I miss it. So clearly this is the real price, and later on, that's the Ribbis price. But how about the case where you give me a discount to pay early? Which is the real price? Is the real price what it's going to be in a month from now, and therefore, assuming the person I'm paying is Jewish, I've got a problem? Or no, that's the real price is right now, and this is sort of a fine for waiting. Yes?
So the real answer is because the borrower is actually lending them the lender money that he doesn't have to get now.
Correct.
And he's getting the rate.
What we call a prepayment discount is actually a way of me getting liquidity earlier, meaning I'm getting your money up front, and I'm willing to pay for that. Right? That is what we call schar hamtanas mos. Schar hamtanas mos shows up in some of the strangest places. Anybody subscribe to anything? Newspapers, magazines? Come on. What do you subscribe to?
Wall Street Journal.
Okay. What's the cover rate on the Wall Street Journal?
No idea. It's free from bad deals.
What?
That's for profit.
What? It's mutter. In fact, malam leyuchsim, based on taking free things. So a typical case, let's say the Wall Street Journal costs $2 a day.
Sounds right.
Okay, and the subscription rate is $200 a year. Right, subscription rates tend to be cheaper than buying it at the newsstand. Oftentimes, significantly so. Now, if I would buy it at the newsstand, so it costs me $2 a day. I buy it 6 days a week. That'd be $12 a week, 52 weeks, I'm paying $600. Now, for $200, not only am I getting it, but you're actually bringing it to me. I'm going to have to go pick it up. So the question is that considered ribbis? Because right? If I would have bought it, I wouldn't be paying for January's issues now. The fact that I'm willing to pay for all of them for the rest of the year, you're giving me a major discount. So is that a problem of ribbis? That's schar hamtanas mos. So well, the argument in favor of allowing this is that no, it's not schar hamtanas mos because the Wall Street Journal could probably do better on financing than what they're giving me now, the 200% interest. If I'm paying $200 for a $600 product, that means they're paying me basically 200% interest on the year for my money. That's not why they do it. They don't do it because they need my cash up front. In fact, oftentimes you can subscribe and play later. They don't care. Why do they do it? The reason that they do it is because the real money they're making is not off of the cost that they're selling it for, but rather the real money they're making is on
advertising.
And therefore, they want the ability to go to the advertiser and say, we have a certain amount of people, 300,000 people, that are going to get this, that are going to buy this no matter what. And guaranteed there'll be 300,000 readers, besides the people who are going to come to the newsstand. Right? So rain, sleet, hail, dark of night, whatever happens, we're going to be selling these papers. Right? So that's why they give me the discount. They give me the discount so they can put me onto the advertiser's list. That's the real reason for it. It's not for the hamtanas mos. So a lot of people say, since you can be getola b'dover acher, that the reason is not because of the hamtanas mos, then you can be mekum. Well, let me ask you another question. The Journal of Halach and Contemporary Society, I think it's $6 an issue. You can buy the two issues for the year for $10 from the RCA. Anyone read the RJJ Journal? No advertising. What? So? What would you say about that? Assuming the RCA is Jewish. I'm just going to Naniyah for now. Well, nope. Any potential hat there?
Well, they want to spread Torah, so they're giving you an incentive.
So why don't they give it to me for free?
Because they have to pay the
cost. I was an economics major. I'm sure they would spread better if it cost nothing. Right, so one could argue that what this actually does is it locks in people to buying it, meaning two things. One is they know how much to publish if you tell them beforehand. Right? They're not gonna have significant overruns or underruns, A. And B, even if they come with those ridiculous David DeSella pool issues, again, that no one really wants, they still can sell those because people subscribed. The idea being that even one can make an argument that even in the academic journals that don't have advertisements, there still might be other reasons to do it. It's significant to note that the discounts are much less in those. Right? Instead of paying 80% off cover price like you'll get at your Time magazine or whatever else, you only get a little bit off when you subscribe to something like Tradition, RJJ Journal, Chavrusa, whatever else, Inayim Otara, whatever else you might want to subscribe to at discount rates. But again, that it's important to know. And a lot of times it's very tricky. It's very tricky to figure out what the real price is.
Why is Tony Lebracher Hetter?
Tony Lebracher is because it's not Schar HaMtonos Mos. I'm paying you for your agreement to do it. It's a little bit like the Costco approach, right? If you'll buy five of them, I'll give it to you for less. That's the idea behind it, the people that are Mako, and I think in general people do subscribe. Right, this, of course, would explain why on Dan's deals you can oftentimes get a free Wall Street Journal, because the reason they're giving it away is because they're making the money off of the advertising. So therefore, there are times where it makes sense for them to literally give it away, and they'll make the money on the back end on the advertisers. That's would be a riot for this as well. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, why you extend student loans?
We'll get to student loans. Okay. Again, even assuming why you is Jewish, well, there'll be other heterium as well. That we can talk about it right now. So we had mentioned earlier that the definition is schar hamtanos mos. Schar hamtanos mos can come either way. It could come in late payment fines. It could come in prepayment discounts. And in both of those, you have a very sometimes difficult way of figuring out what is the real amount. Right? Is the real so? If anyone was a Cy Sims major, oftentimes contracts will say net 30. You know, they'll tell you when the payment has to be made, and there'll be a discount for early payments or a fine for late payments, etc. Because again, in business, particularly for a wholesaler or the like, an important part of your business is cash flow, that you have to remain liquid at all times, right? This is why there's something called factoring. You ever hear of factoring? So what factoring is as follows, just a little bit of, this is your Torah Mata moment for today, that what factoring means is, so let's say I make bed linens, and I sell them to Walmart. So where do I make my bed linens? I make them in Indonesia. I go to Indonesia, I get an order from Walmart. Walmart says they want 500,000 of this color and 400,000 of that color. I then go to Indonesia and I go to a factory and say, I'd like to order all this, right? And then I'm going to ship it to Walmart, right? To Bentonville, Arkansas, and they will distribute it at that point. The Indonesians are not going to give me my bed linens until I pay for it. Walmart's not going to pay for it until they have it. So I've got a problem here, right? Even if I'm paying this guy a nickel for a sheet and I'm charging $5 for it, still somehow or another in the weeks where it comes on the slow boat from China, literally, and it goes to Los Angeles and it's got to go through Los Angeles Customs, etc., right? Somehow or another, I have to have cash to make sure that guy is paid until I get paid from that guy. And oftentimes, this is not the only deal I'm doing now. I have multiple things going on at all times. So there's an entire business called factors. There are people that will come in and buy from me my orders for Walmart. They will hold them as collateral, give me the money to pay the guy in Indonesia. And therefore, then they will collect the money from Walmart, take their money plus their ribbis, and with that, give me the rest of the money once they collected theirs off the top, right? Because this idea of cash flow is very, very important in business. So in any significant business transaction, right, when the payment is going to be and for how much, and every little bit, you miss it. Because if you're missing your payment, I'm going to be missing mine. Right? There's a trickle down. This is all very important. So if someone's actually involved in significant business transactions, this idea of schar hamtanos malos, etc., becomes very important. Now, in these cases, we had mentioned earlier on, there's a major issue of what's midrash d'oraisa and what's midrash d'rabbanan, or the nafkaminas. So one nafkamina we said is whether the sofer is chayav, whether the eidim are chayav, it's just the malvin lover. Another nafkamina we spoke about is whether it's yotzei b'dayanim or not. Right, the Shulchan Aruch quotes a very interesting halacha, which is very relevant to us here. The Shulchan Aruch says that yesobim have a right to lend out their laws for ribis d'rabbanan. So if I'm an apotropos and I'm dealing with Moshe Yisomim, I can actually charge ribis mid-rabbanan and collect it without a problem. The Shulchan Aruch expands on that halacha. I think it's in the Mordechai. The Shulchan Aruch says it's not just an apotropos for Yisomim, but Moos Tzedakah and Moos Beis Knesses can do it as well. If I'm a tzedakah organization, I have a right to charge ribis mid-rabbanan. So, what is the definition of a tzedakah organization? And what is the definition of ribis d'rabbanan? So we said ribis katsutza, ribis d'oraisa is where I give you cash, and for the cash, you give me more cash back. Right? Many cases do not fall into that. For example, ribis me'uchar. What's ribis me'uchar? You say, can I borrow $10? I say, sure, here's $10. When are we going to have it back? I'll have it back for you next week. Next week I say, okay, where's my $10? You say, well, I don't got it. Okay, so what do you mean you don't got it? And you say, I don't got it. Say, but I owe someone else $10. You know, this is, so you say, okay, I'll give you $11 back if you wait another week. Right? So since b'shas halva, the agreement wasn't made, that's when Mr. Rabban. That's one example. Okay? Another example is shtaros. This is when it gets important. So, shtaros sound very arcane, but shtaros happen to be very, very important nowadays in business. Right? Well, how would you define a shtar in modern day terms? Contract. Specific contract. We're talking about here's an IOU. Right? A bond basically is, if I buy a treasury bond, what I'm doing is I'm saying to the U.S. government, you know, they say, we want to borrow some money, right? And we're going to pay you back $10,000 in 10 years for it. How much money, you know, would you give us for that? That's what a bond auction is. So let's say nowadays it's $9,000. So a bond is, I give you $9,000 now, and you give me $10,000 back. Okay. Rare is the case where a person buys a 10-year bond, holds it for 10 years, and then collects the money. Right? There's something called the bond market out there. Right? There's something called Moody's, who hates us for all the right reasons. Right? Every bond, right, whether it's a U.S. Treasury bond, or whether it's a corporate bond, or in our case, a junk bond, right? Any, right? Or sub-junk bond, right? Every case of a bond is just an IOU. And the value of the bond changes with time. So say the U.S. government, let's say I'm not worried about them paying back. People don't worry about the government paying back because if they ever ran out of money, they could print more, right? So unless they ran out of paper and ink, they're probably good from here on in, right? So again, if with 10 years to go, I buy the bond's worth $9,000. If nothing else happens in a year from now, it's probably going to be worth $9,100 because I don't have to wait as long. So even if the interest rates don't change, the value of the bond goes up. Now, the interest rates could change for a wide variety of reasons. One is inflation. That could throw things off. Or it could also change because the credit worthiness gets thrown off, right? When YU sold their bonds, right, they were getting 97 cents on a dollar. Now, they're getting 2 nickels and a can, I think, is what we get for it now. right? As the credit worthiness, if a company loses hundreds of millions of dollars with no end in sight, people with the bonds begin to get worried that they're never going to get paid. Therefore, the value of the bond drops. That's how you can tell what people are thinking about it. That's how all of this works. So, shtaros, bonds, automatically have a certain amount of ribis built into it. But they're not cash. So let's say I go and I swap a bond with you. Or I buy a bond at one price, I sell it at another price, etc. Right? Anything you do on the bond market basically is going to be ribis mizrabanim. Because you're really buying and selling IOUs, which are shtaros. Right? And whoever the issuing party is the person who's the borrower. And then I'm giving a certain amount of money for the right to collect the money. Right? There might be coupons, it might not be coupons. And as time goes on, I might want cash, I might think that it's going to go down, whatever it is. There's a very active bond market out there. You can buy bond funds, etc. Yes?
But is the initial bond sale from YU to, would that be considered the bond sale? Because that's from the initial money's changing.
No, that would be the RISA. Right? Because YU's taking in money, and they're going to pay back money. Right? This is just representing that. Right? We're talking about the secondary market here. So that is midrabanan. So whenever you're dealing with bonds, and there's a lot of business that goes with the bonds, that's ribis derabanan. Nowadays, if I want to take out money, if I want to pay something, in most cases I do not use cash, but rather I will oftentimes use a check. What is the status of a check? Is a check ribis derabanan? Is it a shtar, or is it cash?
There's no inflation on the check.
There's no value
in
the check.
What?
There's no inflation, or it doesn't fluctuate the value of the check.
Well, that's not necessarily true. So, for example, if you give me a check for $100...
And you didn't cash it for another year.
No, I'm not talking about that. And, you know, I don't know how much money is in your bank account. So if I would try to sell someone the check, you know, they would kind of try to figure out the value of it. Which is why check cashing places don't give you 100 cents on the dollar. Right? Because a check has some risk in it. A check is very different than a bond, though, because a bond allows me to collect the money from you. The check allows me to collect the money from the bank. Right? You're giving me a piece of paper that's allowing me to take money from him. That's a little different than a piece of paper that allows me to take money from you. So that's a major discussion as to whether a transaction done with a check is considered done with cash or a shtar. There are many opinions out there. Rabbi Bleich, as expected, has the most interesting ones. Rabbi Bleich at one time was of the opinion that if I give you a dollar and you give me four quarters, that's ribis. Because the dollar has no intrinsic value, but the quarters do. Most people don't assume that way. However, once you're dealing with a check, right away, we're dealing with ribis derabanan, according to many poskim. Now, that being said, let's go on to the question of why use student loans. When I take out a student loan from Yeshiva University, what do they give me?
A check.
They cut me a check. Right? I'm going to get a check. I'm likely going to return a check. Assuming that I say that the status of a check is something like a bond, something of an IOU, a piece of paper where I obligate myself to pay you a certain amount of money, but it itself is not legal tender. Were I to assume that, so again, this transaction will be ribis only midrabanan because of what I am dealing with. I'm not dealing with cash. Assuming that YU is a tzedakah organization, it would be mutter, according to the Shulchan Aruch, for them to deal in ribis derabanan. It's very interesting. The person who's in charge of YU student loans now is a fellow named Bob Friedman, I'm sure many of you know. Bob Friedman, whose nickname is Bob the Guy, because Bob's a guy, despite his last name Friedman, right? So when he first started out here, we had offices not far from each other, and he got a letter from somebody saying that, you know, I took out a YU student loan, and I'm willing to pay back the loan, but because of my religious beliefs, I will not pay ribbis, I will not pay the interest. So what did Bob say? Gaius Shakab? He said, okay. So, Bob, so I had to explain to them, no, this is ribbis for a butter, Bob. So it actually is a letter they have, which they send out, they say on a regular basis they get these letters of people that decide that they're not paying their YU loans back because of ribbis concerns. And the response goes back that don't worry about it, right? Because we think that we're okay on this one, right? So that is the, so again, the difference between ribbis d'oraisa and ribbis d'rabbanan, that becomes very important. Now, again, if I am a hotshot corporate lawyer, so I spend a lot of time writing out contracts, and most of the time I'm writing my contracts, they involve ribbis. So, that being said, who am I writing in between? So, when we're talking about real estate, I hate to sound like an anti-Semite here, there's a lot of Jews involved. Both on the buying side and the selling side, and there's always going to be some rigorous contingency out there. So one could say that if you have this cool out there, that the checks have a din of shtar, because they have a din of shtar, it's only ribbis d'rabbanan, right? So then, it could be the malv and the lova have an issue being involved in this, but you as the sofer do not have this problem. What about lifnei iver? Should it at least be lifnei iver? So this is what we call chad iver denara. What people are familiar with this? The basic overview is that lifnei iver only applies if it can't be done by anyone else. What's called trei iver denara, they need you to get from one side of the river to the other. This is chad iver denara. Baruch Hashem, there are many, many attorneys out there who could probably do this, not as well as you, of course, but still well enough. So therefore, they'd be able to be mekel. Then there's something called misayer de'orever, which is nis d'rabbanon. So again, there's ways to get it. Misayer is not the hardest thing to get around. That's the story with that. Another major issue in ribbis, one of the most major issues in ribbis, is the old Israeli issue of b'yehudi. What's considered a Jew? So I bank with Citibank. I am Jewish. What about Citibank? Are they Jewish? Who owns Citibank?
Shareholders,
right? So Citibank is traded on the New York Stock Exchange. It's a publicly traded corporation. What percentage of the stock do you think is owned by Jews? Think of that number. And add to that, what percentage of the mutual funds that own stock in Citibank are held by Jews? And add to that, what percentage of pension funds that own stock are actually representing Jews? You probably will come up with a non-insignificant number. Right? You know, let's say 10%. Yeah, that's reasonable. Maybe even on the low side. Therefore, when I get a dollar of interest from Citibank, how much of that came from Jews? 10 cents. So every dollar I do, I'm getting a dime from Jews. That would seem to be a problem. So let's say you have a case of Shutfin. Let's say there is a partnership between a Jew and a non-Jew. Can I charge ribbis? Can I pay ribbis to this partnership? So the answer is no. Assuming that a Jew is getting a pruta worth of ribbis, this is problematic. So Citibank or Chase Manhattan or basically any bank out there, it's very interesting, we'll just take a step back. I remember when Chad Greenwald, there he goes again, happened to be living in America, so he at one point decided he was going to take out a mortgage. But he was machmir that he didn't think that any of the corporations really had a din of a guy. So because of that, he decided what he wants to do is he wants to find a totally non-Jewish owned bank to take his mortgage from. Anyone think of any totally non-Jewish banks?
Deutsche Bank.
Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank. What?
No.
Bank of Dubai. Bank of Dubai, I think, was good. And the United Emirates Bank.
Both of those are owned by Jews. There's a recent article about it.
What?
Those
are government owned.
What,
those two.
Oh.
Those two.
But
United Emirates and Bank of Dubai. Either. What?
Arab banks don't take interest either. They have their own,
They don't take it from Arabs.
They have interest also, then.
They have, kind of. It's a little bit better, in a sense.
It's better.
In a sense. if you look and learn about it,
So, yeah, we're going to hold off on Sharia law until next week. But for the time being, we're just focused on us. Right, so that's a major issue. The major issue is, how do you define a corporation in terms of its Jewishness or not Jewishness? This is a question that significantly impacts Ribbis, but it impacts other things as well. Right, owning stock in McDonald's, right? Would that be problematic? V'chulei v'chulei. All stock ends up, whether it's Basar B'cholov, whether it's Ribbis, whether it's one of many other issues, right? The question of what does a corporation mean is a major question in halacha, and it particularly comes through here in Ribbis. The little background of law: so corporations are what's called the legal fiction. It's like mechiras chametz, right? It's something that doesn't really exist, but we kind of pretend that it does. Meaning as follows: that there are certain times out there, and again, this is the last century or so that this began, where the government makes up entities and makes up rules that really don't make any logical sense just because they want to encourage the economy one way or another. Lynn Marshall, bankruptcy, right? I borrow $100,000 from you. I don't have the money to pay back. So what does halacha say? You don't have, you don't have. A year, 2 years, 3 years, you don't have, you don't have. After 10 years, if I win the lottery, first thing you do is you pay back your debts. That's not how American world works. American world is I have a right to declare bankruptcy, right? I declare bankruptcy, and if I win the lottery the next day, you don't get it. Doesn't matter. How luckily do we accept bankruptcy? Let's say I borrowed $100,000 for you. I declare bankruptcy, then I won the lottery. Now you take me to Beis Din. Will they allow you to collect the money for me?
How were you able to buy the ticket?
What?
You were able to buy the ticket.
That, where do you think all the money went? So there's a major discussion where Moshe Feinstein thinks that Dina de Machos Susa Dina does apply in that case. And the fact that a Beis Din would not do it as well. Interesting Beis Din questions all the time. And I've had cases with patent law. Right? Does halacha accept patent law as either the Balchusa? I thought so. So too, there's a concept called corporations. What does corporations mean and why do they do it? Corporations means as follows, that I open a pizza store, but I don't open up in my name, I open a name as the Washington Heights Pizza Store. I open it up and I'm selling pizza, v'chulei, and I have different flavors. I have regular, I have cheese, I have extra cheese. I accidentally had a rat poison one time, right? So people go and they order the rat poison pizza and they get deathly ill. So I offer them their money back for the pizza, but somehow or another that doesn't make them happy. So what do we do now? So they're going to sue. So according to the rules of corporations, you can sue me. And you can get sued, everything, you can take my whole pizza store away from me, but you can't go after me in most cases individually. That right now, the pizza store is its own entity. I have to be 100% owner of that entity, but it exists on its own. And therefore, if you get food poisoning from my food, or if you slip on your own shovel, or whatever else has gone wrong, you're only entitled to collect the value of the corporation. You can't get more than that, right? Why does the United States government come up with this idea? Why do all governments at this point basically have this idea? Because they want to encourage business. If I have $10 million in the bank, so $10 million in the bank, I invest it wisely, I make 5%, that's $500,000 a year, that's enough for me to live on. Why in the world would I want to open a business? A If I open a business, it goes wrong. I could lose everything. I could be poor. But the government wants us to open a business. If you open up a business, then people will be employed, and then products will be purchased, and there'll be economic activity, and it'll make us the powerhouse that we once were. Right? That's what we want. Right? So therefore, in order to encourage me to open businesses, the government takes away the liability. At what cost? Why wouldn't anyone want to do this? So the cost is double taxation. Once it's a new entity, so the I have to pay corporate taxes from the corporation. They pay taxes. And then when they divide the profits and I get my share, I pay taxes on that again. So that's the trade-off. The trade-off is I pay double taxation, I get rid of liability. So the question is, well, halachically, do we accept any of this? According to this, who owns the... I don't own the pizza store. The pizza store is ownerless. So can there be such a concept out there? Something that's owned, but there's no individual, there's no bylum, there's no individuals? Can you really separate this? So a lot of people try to figure this out. Right? That there are many tshuvas about this. There seems to be some cases in the Gemara which are similar to that. For example, when a mafrish, meiser ani, before I give it to the ani of my choice, who owns it? So the shevet aniyim own it. Right? Before I give out my truma, the shevet kohanim own it. Like it's jointly owned. Who owns the shul? So there's a lot of discussion about this. So there, Moshe Feinstein has an interesting split on it, right? But Moshe basically says that a person has a right to accept ribbis from a corporation, but you can't pay ribbis to an organization, to a corporation. Meaning that I can put my money in the bank and get interest for it, but I can't take out a mortgage. I can't pay my credit cards late. I can't use overdraft. I can't take out a car loan. According to Rav Moshe, it's a one-way street. People argue on both sides. Therefore, people should try to be more careful about this, and people should try to avoid paying ribbis, even to a corporation. Right? Just because we're Mako, we put our money in the bank, and we do take interest payments, doesn't necessarily mean it goes the other way. All right, so that being said, so what do you do about mortgages? How does a person go about doing a mortgage? So we'll use this as an opportunity to discuss the concept of a heter iska. These are the basics of a heter iska. Basically, you come to me and you'd like to borrow $100,000 again to open the pizza store, right? How much interest do I want for my money? I like 8%. Okay, if I say I like 8% back on it, that's ribbis ktsutsa. A heter iska is what we call palva milva, palga pikadon, right? It's half a loan, half an investment. So again, instead of giving you $100,000, I say, I'm giving you 50 and 50. Okay? $50,000 is a loan. $50,000 is an investment in the pizza store. The loan is interest-free, and at the end of the year, I would like back how much? $50,000. The investment is not interest-free. It's interest-free, but again, I would like to partake in the profits now that I am an investor here. Now, I am a silent investor here. I am not involved in the actual business of running the pizza store. So, because of that, I don't really know if we're making money, if we're losing money, right? It's a cash business. I don't know what's coming. I don't know what's going. I don't know what we're really paying. Therefore, I say, obviously, in order to do this, I want some sort of guarantee that the money that is going out, right, and the money that's coming in, I have a good idea and I know what my entitlements are. Therefore, I have a certain request. I'd like to see the books at the end of the year, and I want to be sure the books are correct. Therefore, I would like the books to be audited by a Big Four accounting firm, and then double checked by a major law firm. And after that, when you give it in, I want you to swear on a Sefer Torah that it's true. However, in the event that you'd rather not go through that, I understand, there's definitely a certain amount of profit. If you told me you made it, I would believe you. If you come to me and say we made a 50% profit on it, I know you're not lying to me. So I'm going to set that number at 16%. If you tell me, if you just check off that there's a 16% profit on our money here, you don't got to swear, you don't got to bring in the auditors, I'm fine with that. So 16% profit on $50,000 is how much? Let's say 8,000, because that's the right number. Okay, we'll divide 16 by 2. Let's say it's 8. Right? So if you check off on that, which you likely will, because the cost of you getting the auditors, etc., you probably don't want to swear on a Sefer Torah, makes it somewhat prohibitive. You will then end up paying me how much for this? See, there's a reason why no one here is an actuary. You'll pay me $58,000. At the end of the year, I will end up with how much money? $108,000. And I, in fact, will have made my 8% interest that I was looking for. See how we did that? This is the basic heter iska. The basic heter iska is that part of it is a loan, part of it is an investment. I am pointing to an investment profit that is reasonable. And once you have that reasonable investment thing, well, you're going to do that. You run the numbers, it's going to end up being what you had hoped for. Now, this is the very basics. There's a lot more to it. Right? Don't try this at home. For example, you're entitled to a salary for running the pizza store. Right? If there's a 60% profit, you probably deserve more than I do because you're actually running around running the pizza business and I'm not doing anything. Right? So therefore, that has to be taken into account. Right? There has to be a reasonable possibility that you can turn around and see and say that, you know, it didn't work out. Heter iskas are very tricky. Very, very tricky for many reasons. Right? Some of them halachic reasons, some of them practical reasons. Right? So let's give an example here. So let's take a mortgage. Okay? This building, right over the both buildings you show here at the end are both for sale right now. Right? You know, about number 4 and number 14 here, they're both for sale if anyone's interested in it. Right? You can mortgage this way, you can stay and touch the basement and then and the building at the same time. Okay, they're like $800,000 for this building right here. Okay? $800,000. So let's say I'm interested in buying it. How much am I going to put down on it? Let's say I put down 30%. 30% is how much money? $40,000. The rest I'm going to finance. That means I need how much to finance? $560,000. I'm looking at a jumbo loan here. I go to the Berkshire Bank on the other side of the Heights. 100% owned by one Moses Marks, right? I'd like to take out a mortgage on this. So being that we're all fine, upstanding religious Jews, at least he is, we're gonna do a heter iska here, right? Now the problem with this heter iska is as follows. The problem with this heter iska is everybody knows what I'm investing in. I'm investing in this house. The value of this house also is kind of publicly known. You go on Trulia, you go on any of the websites, and they'll tell you, the market went up, the market went down. Right? Let's say, 2 years after I buy this, you know, the YU goes bankrupt, and they turn this into, tenement housing for maybe recovering drug addicts. Odds are the price of my house is going to go down if that would happen. Right? So the question is it really fair for me to keep on saying, okay, you know, I want the books, if everybody knows what happened here? Right? So that's a halachic problem. So similarly, this becomes an issue with YU student loans. When you take out a YU student loan, it says it's being done al pi heter iska. And YU does have a heter iska these days. It was drafted by Rabbi Reis. He used to work here. And before he became Rosh Hashiva. And also Rabbi Blech. Where basically, they set up one of these things. But wait a second. Let's say I take out a student loan. So how does that work exactly? Anybody ever think of a YU student loan? So what happens? Did they give you money?
Because it comes from the captain.
Yeah.
Right?
What?
I went over.
Okay, then they get, so you took out $10,000, you owed $5,000, so they gave you $5,000, something like that? Right, so about half the money you never saw. Right. So the problem is, if you never see the money, it's hard to say that you're investing it in something.
I'm paying my fees, my tuition.
Correct. Now, how did you make money on this? So again, think about how you're going to structure a heter iska at this point, right? Why you give me $10,000? Half it's a loan, half what? Where? Who? What? I'm investing it in, where's the pizza store? You know, where are the books that have to be ordered in? If they're just erasing an IOU, it becomes very difficult to fit that into a heter iska because there is no iska. So writing a heter iska in that place, in that situation, becomes near impossible. Now there are potential approaches. You could say that, well, I'm investing in intellectual capital, and my YU degree will allow me to get a job as whatever. So as a security guard one day, and now my college degree, that it'll pay off in that way, right? That is one possibility. You can take it that way. Another possibility is no. In fact, I had the money to pay my tuition, and now by them taking this, I'm taking that money and I'm investing it elsewhere. That's a stretch, right? These would be the logical attempts that you might make, but these are halachic reasons that it's very difficult to do a heter iska in many cases, right? You have the case of a mortgage where you know what the investment is, and it's clear to everybody whether it's going up or down. Your demands of auditable books just makes no sense. And now in the other case, you have places where the money is also not going towards an ISCA. What do you do in these cases? Right. So these are times where heter ISCAs become very difficult. Just to say, okay, here's a standard form, a heter ISCA klali, that's going to take care of everything. No, it doesn't really, because not everything, things don't often lend themselves to a heter ISCA. That's a problem here. Now, in the case of the YU, basically, the answer is that the heter iska they have is useless, probably. Right? There's a pretty good chance. But it doesn't matter, because since we're dealing with Rivas Dirabanan and it's a stock organization, they don't really need a heter iska, thankfully. However, when you're talking about mortgages, this is a place where, yeah, you do really need a heter iska. So therefore, there have been many different approaches as to how we can get around this, right? Rabbi Aaron Levine, of blessed memory, who used to teach this class far better than I do, was a big fan of the following approach. In general, do you have an amortization table? An amortization table goes like this. When let's say, so a $560,000 loan over 30 years, so to pay off the principal would be how much a year? That would be $19,000 a year plus interest. So let's say you're going to pay $2,500 a month. Okay? Here's I'm paying $2,500 a month. I'm going to pay $2,500 the first month. I'm going to pay $2,500 the second month. I'm going to pay $2,500 the third month, and I'm going to keep on paying that for the next 360 months. So month one, month two, month three, month 360. All the same amounts. That's how a mortgage works. However, while it all looks the same, it's really very different. In the first month, I pay $2,500. Ruba de ruba of this is interest, because I'm paying interest of $560,000. So in the first month, it might be something like $2,420 of Karen and $80 of what we're going to have to call ribs, which is Hebrew for interest. The next month, I don't owe $560,000 anymore, right? I only owe $5,559,920. So therefore, I only have to pay, let's say, $2,418, and therefore $82 is going towards it. And there's a snowball effect. So over the first months and years, you're paying off very little of the Karen, right? The majority of your payments are what?
I think you flipped the words Karen and ribs.
No, I don't think I did. Okay. But I'm paying, you're right. You win. You're paying an awful lot of ribis, you see, in the first month, right? And eventually, the last payment's going to be probably like a dollar for ribis and $24.99 for Karen, because I owe very little money at that point, or something like that. This is what's called an amortization table, that somehow or another we've been able to fix the numbers that the payment's the same amount every month for all of these months. However, if after 5 years I default on my mortgage, I own very little of my house. If after 20 years I default on my mortgage, I'm entitled to a lot of the house. So that's the way amortization tables work. That's the way that a typical mortgage plays out. Rabbi Levine has the following approach that he always wanted to say. He said, well, when I first move into my house, who owns the house?
The bank.
The bank owns the house. And every month I'm paying a little bit of the house. Why am I paying them extra money? So according to this setup, I'm not paying it because of any other reason. I'm paying for ribis. But who's living in the house? Me or the bank? I'm living in the house. So if I'm living in the bank's house, I should be paying rent. So here's the opinion. If you just take out this and you replace it with the word rent, every month I buy a little bit more of the house. Since I own more of the house, I'm renting less of the house. And with that, I'm buying the house piece by piece from the bank. And then, and besides that, it's more of a sort of a rent-to-own type of setup. And this takes care of all ribis problems because there's no ribis whatsoever. This would seem to be a wonderful way to take care of it, but there are downsides. Yes?
But you agreed, let's say it's worth whatever it's worth in the beginning, so the shaha that you bought it was $800,000, but you end up paying. Yes, you end up paying.
Well, you know, if mortgages work, I imagine I'll be paying something like $1.2 million,
huh? Yeah. So, well, how's that factored into the idea of
not factored at all. I mean, the bank bought the house. I mean, I've been living in an apartment building for the last 20 years. I paid them a lot of money. I got nothing to show for it. Other than the fact that I had a roof over my head for 20 years. So that's what's going on here also. Until I can afford to buy my house, I'm renting from them.
So the fact that you agreed to pay $400,000...
Again, this $800,000 goes to the current owner. Right? Right? And they're getting money from me and from the bank. We are partners in this house. But I'm the one who's living in the house. So therefore, I have to pay the bank because it owns part and I'm living in their house. So, that being said, this sounds brilliant. It is brilliant. But it has a problem. So, for example, let's say I don't shovel my snow. And somebody slips and falls and now sues. Who do they sue? Well, who owns the house? Traditionally, I do, and therefore I get sued. Under this, the bank does.
Yeah, but it's not suing.
The bank owns the house. They have a responsibility to keep the sidewalk clean.
Perhaps the small portion that you own comes with the responsibility that you will shovel.
So okay, so again, so, yeah, you, so again, on the one hand, I can sign a release of liability, but let's say the guy who slips says, yeah, that's lovely. So let's say I go and I do damage to you. You sue me, but I get some homeless guy to say that he'll cover the liability. Now you have to sue him, and he has no money, and you can't get it. Do you have a right to contractually stop me? So the fact that I signed over to the bank, so what is, how does that help? How does that help? I can't. Unless my pockets are as deep as the bank's pockets, this isn't going to do anything. So the bank can make me take out insurance, right? They can try to think of every possibility and insure against it. But that's something that it's going to have to be worked out. Similarly, in this case, this actually, I hear about this from time to time. If anyone knows any corporate law, if a company goes bankrupt, there's an order who collects. So what's called the secure lenders are the first ones to collect. I lend you money, and I have a lien on that in particular. That's called the secure lender. If you go bankrupt, I get to take to that. After the secured creditors comes the unsecured creditors. And this goes on and on and on. The last people to collect anything, if you have a bankruptcy, is the stockholders, the equity owners. Right? The equity owners are the last ones to collect. If I lend you money under a regular interest agreement, this is entirely a loan, and if you go bankrupt, I'm first on line. If we sign a RIBIS agreement, what do I become? I become now an equity holder. I'm a stockholder in your company, and I'm the last one to collect. So I'm willing to fill it, but I don't want to give up. And you can't contract that I'm the first one to collect, because there's a third-party beneficiary. The other creditors say, I'm like, what's this? You can't give away our money. So heter iscas, in their most basic forms, are difficult, but they rarely remain in their most basic forms because of legal considerations, because of halachic considerations. So this is why you got to be very careful with these things. And as somebody who's seen many heter iscas filled out by many people, not everybody who fills out a heter isca knows what they're doing, right? If their first name is Rabbi. So heter iscas in general, one has to be very, very careful with, because again, there's many considerations that go into it, and it's also oftentimes it's very difficult. Every set of rules is different. My shlemazel, I was just at the Yom HaTzvot free food thon, so I sat myself right in front of the food. It was best in the house. And then Rabbi Shafter sat on one side, Rabbi Khan sat on the other side. That was the end of my having a good time. So I once I have you have Rabbi Shafter sitting next to you, you take advantage of it. So I said to him, Basin just got a shiloh. The shiloh has to do as follows. There's something called points. You ever hear points? Points means as follows. That I take out a $500,000 loan, right? $500,000 loan, what's the rate now for a $500,000 loan? What? 6%, 5%.
Sorry, 3 or 4, I think.
4%, good, 6. So oftentimes they'll say, we'll give you a 4%, or we'll give you 3.5% plus 2 points. Safety? Right? 2 point garris? What is this? You know. So points are as follows. Right? Points mean as follows: that I pay you additional money up front, and you give me a lower interest rate going forward. So, for example, in this case, I could either pay. Take out. You give me $500,000, and for that I pay 4%. Or I will pay you $10,000. For the right to take $500,000 at 3.5%. How in the world would you write a heter iscah for that?
Well, theoretically, you're getting
So you're saying, write $490,000 loan, right?
Right, and then
and do it at three, and then write out the interest figure it out. The interest rate
at 3.5.
At 3.5 at 500.
Right.
Right? You have to do the interest rate back on the original number. So that was a suggestion, but the person said, wait a second. If you took out a mortgage and we agreed at $500,000 at 3.5%, but then the mortgage papers say $490,000 at 3.6%, you probably would, as an attorney, say, wait a second, that's not what we agreed on. That's not what we agreed on. Right? They said, no one will let this go through.
Well, say you write it as 490, and then in parentheses, less than 10,000, which was paid as the points, and have the clause that covers the points.
How are you going to fit that into here? Theodoriska.
Just have a little asterisk at the top of the 490 saying that it's really a value of fine, but just write it, make sure everything's included.
So it's interesting. There's a fair amount of literature out there. Rabbi Bleich is a supporter of this, which says, for example, going back to this case where I'm concerned about secured debtors versus equity holders, I have a right to say that this is all for religious understandings. But as far as court interpretation goes, assume that this is a regular interest loan. So Rabbi Bleich thinks that's fine, Rabbi Schefter thinks the whole thing's a joke. Rabbi Schefter doesn't understand why that would make any sense whatsoever. So, but again, as I said to Rabbi Schefter, well, what's bothering you about this? Is bothering you about that the guy can collect on bankruptcy? Like, is this the American law that you find offensive here? If that's the case, I'm sorry, but my life goes on. So again, these are once you have the ability to write things two different ways, well, then you have a little bit more flexibility. Even that, but it's very hard to do it with this case. As you, if you try to do it, you'll see. Well, just so again, in terms of serious ribis, heter iskas, etc., this is the alapes of it. So the alapes of it, there's plenty more when it comes to that, because again, it's very hard to get it to work out in a way that both halakhically and legally it'll just end up looking the way that you really want it to look. The other issues that come up in ribis, it's very interesting. This must be a course in seminary. The Midas Dom course, hike we borrow a cup of sugar, no, I'm not allowed to because of ribis. Oftentimes among young marries, we find this in the building, which is why I told my wife, when you go to people saying, I like a cup of sugar to keep as a gift, I don't intend on giving it back to you, okay? Right? That's not a ribis problem. That's fine.
We said borrowing is not a problem.
What?
It's
a borrowing. So where does this idea come from, right? So this concept called sa'ah b'sa'ah. Sa'ah b'sa'ah means that I can't lend you a sa'ah, a measure of flour, and take it and then return another one. Basically, the story goes like this. If you look at there's a very hard parak.
It's different than the car because you're giving the same car back.
Correct.
Or different gas.
Correct. There's a difference between that. The difference between that, well, one case, I'm giving you the same car and I'm paying you some gas.
You don't borrow a piece of paper, you just want the piece of paper.
Right. Like, you know, can I borrow a tissue?
Yeah.
No, we just keep it. When you're done with it, I don't really want it back. Thank you for your concern. Right? Sabasai talks about a case where I'm borrowing a cup of sugar and I'm going to return a different cup of sugar. Right? In general, there is an issue of currency. For example, if I borrow, let's say it's 4 shekel to the dollar, and I borrow $10 in Israel, what do I owe you? Do I owe you $10 or do I owe you 40 shekel? Right? That's the question, figure out what the currency is. This is the famous case, there is a perek, the fourth perek in Bava Tzia, perek Hazav. It says, Hazav kones a kesef. And if you look at your Shalmi, the perek is called perek HaKesef, because it says, HaKesef kones Hazav. But there has to be one set currency, wherever you are, right? Because everything changes prices. So something has got to be put as set, right? So for example, in the United States, the dollar is the currency, right? We don't take into account inflation. Right? If I give you a loan, you don't have a right to for an inflation adjustment in general. There are tshuvas about in times in Eretz Yisrael when there was what's called galloping inflation. When they had very high inflation rates, maybe that would make a difference. But in general, you know, I give you a loan, even though in terms of real money I'm losing on it, I can't take any ribis on it. Right? So the question is, in general, when you deal with commodities change in value. So if I give you a bag of flour, in a week from now, the value of the bag of flour may be more. So I gave you $2 of flour, now you give me $2.10 worth of flour, that's what's called sabasa, that's the potential isarivis. It sounds silly until you go to the COMEX. COMEX is commodities exchange. This is how people make a parnasa. They buy and sell commodities, right? This is always the joke that, you know, most people in commodities, what I'll do is I'll buy, right now, I guess the most popular commodity is barrels of oil. Right, so Western Brent crude is at $105 a barrel. Right, I'm going to buy crude November delivery at $105 a barrel, and I'm going to make sure to close out my position before November, because the last thing I want is someone to knock on my door with a tanker full of oil. I don't really want it. I'm just betting on the values of it, of whether it's going to go up or down. Right, so again, if I lend you oil and you pay me back oil, but there are people who are making their panasa by doing this, right? That the value is going to go one way or the other, right? Right. That's a value. Right? It's, this is the same thing as shorting stocks. Do people even know what shorting stocks are? Yes? Anybody not? Okay. So here's what shorting stocks are, right? Apple computer hit $600 yesterday. I think it's going to go up. I buy stock, I make money. Good. Let's say it's going to go down. How do I make money on that? I say I don't have it. You don't make money by selling, you just don't lose money. So you do what's called shorting a stock. Right? What you do is I say, can I borrow 100 shares of Apple? I'll pay you back next month. And you lend me 100 shares of Apple, I sell it.
To a third party or to Apple?
To a third party. Right? I borrow the stock from you, I sell it, 100 shares at $600, I get $600,000. In a month, that's at $500. I buy 100 shares, I give it back to you. I made $10,000. That's what's called shorting a stock. That's how you make money when stocks go down.
How's the benefit of the person who sells them to you? Well, they get their money back?
What?
The broker. How does it benefit the broker?
The broker.
The lender?
The third party already lost money. He doesn't want to lose more, so he just sells you.
How does it benefit the lender?
So the lender. So usually the person, the lender, will be the broker who's going to make money on the commissions on my trades. That's it. So if they have stock to lend,
because they already lost money on the stock and went down, right?
So again, so that person, he's going to let. If he has no intention, either there'll be some charge to borrow it, or he'll make the money on the side somehow or another. So that's what's called shorting stocks, right? Right, the idea is that I am borrowing 100 shares of Apple, I am returning 100 shares of Apple. So if I am right and it's worth less, then there's no river, Shiloh. If I guess wrong and then Apple goes up to $700, I have a ribus problem. Not only did I lose $10,000, but I also have a ribus issue. Right? If I'm right in my bet, I am rich and I am mutter. If I am wrong in my bet, I have lost my pants, and I was over a lot. How's that for a bad day? Right? So clearly, these cases, right? So this is where sabasa comes from. Now again, that it makes sense once you get a global view of how the markets work. Why there would be an isser of sabasa? We get that, right? How does that play out with your cup of flour, right? From the neighbor from Sodom, who, due to her concerns, will not give you that cup of flour. So the answer is that there are many hetera for sabasa on the smaller cause. One is there's a concept called yeshva. If I have some flour, I can even borrow much more flour. Right? What yeshva means, actually not only that, but if I would want to do this, let's say I want to borrow 3 dozen eggs. I can ask you to please give me an egg, and then I can borrow the other 35. But once Yeshel, I have one, that's fine. Nothing is Yotza Hashtar. If I could readily buy it at this point and sell it at a set price, that's also not a problem of Sabasa. Right? So when it comes to Sabasa, again, it's an issue through our button. There are ways around it, particularly when you're dealing with these small amounts. If a person wants to be machmir, say, okay, Can I please have an egg? I'm not borrowing egg, I need an egg. Right? Most neighbors hopefully will give you the egg, and if you decide to pay it back, that's fine. If not, or you can offer to buy one for a quarter. If that that would make them feel better. That's, there are other ways around this. So the sudden they say, yeah, people being very nervous to lend out commodities, really on the household level, it's not really a major issue. Is there a question in there? Okay. Yeah, so these are some of the issues of ribis. So I wasn't hoping to teach you everything here. These are just some of the things to be aware of. Ribis comes in the most complex. I'll throw out one more case. This actually comes up oftentimes. People don't realize it. So I'm a kolonik. I get married. I like to buy a house. So I go to the bank. I like to take out a mortgage. They say, well, what do you do for a living? I say, I do the holiest thing in the world. I learn Torah. That's wonderful. So you're unemployed. Yeah. All right, it's another way of putting it, right? So they're not interested in giving me a mortgage for whatever reason. So my father-in-law, he goes and he takes out a mortgage on my behalf, right? And I will make the payments. So is that okay?
He's a co-signer.
No, he's not a co-signer. He is the signer. Right? Again, so he has a job, so he says, okay, here I want a $500,000 loan. In the event, and the bank knows if anyone defaults, they'll go right after him. So what's the story with that? Right? So it's very nice of him. So because of him, I'm getting a loan from the bank. The bank isn't Jewish, we should be okay. Truth is no, because really what's happening here is he owes the bank money. So the bank gives him $100,000. He gives me the $100,000. Now I'm paying back $1,000 a month for the next 15 years. Right, so he gave me $100,000, and now I paid $180,000 worth of debt for him. That's what we call ribis. Right. The hardest simon in ribis is the one that talks about the involvement of non-Jews. Theoretically, one could do a lot better than a heter iska by just getting a guy. How would that work? So let's say Rabbi Oren would like to borrow $100,000 from me. I like $110,000. So I go to Stan Watson. I said, Stan, I'd like to lend you $100,000 for $110,000. He says, no problem. You say, Stan, I'd like to borrow $100,000. I'll pay you $110,000. He says, no problem. He gives you the $100,000. The time's up, you give him $110,000, he gives it to me. We have two separate transactions. Both of them were mutter. Done. What do you think about that move? It reminds me of Rabbi Tendler, who was once here on a Friday night. So he was talking to you that the Tish, this is before we saw a global came, so it wasn't called the Tish yet, it was just the Shear then. So he got up and he said as follows. He said that when they opened up Shaarei Tzedek Medical Center, he was involved in making all the Brahma things. So he explains how it works. Like you flip a light, nothing happens, Akash Baruch Hu turns his back and the lights go on. That was a direct quote from him. So they said when they were going to open San Zalaniato in Netanya, so the Kloisenberger called him down to the Jersey and said, no, I want to know what you did. So he's going to explain, we can do the grum of this and the grum of that. And the Kloisenberger was just looking at him incredulously for the whole time. And he finally said to him, Chobashayla, from what says the Eivish HaGemach, does I feel Goyim? Why did God make so many Goyim? Clearly, so they'll turn on the lights for us. He didn't understand. Like, what are we going through all this? What if we just let it out? I say, okay, Abu, flip on the lights. Abu, write this down. He just didn't get the whole thing. So did ribis. For us as the Shagamach, does I feel by him? That would seem to be the very basic question here. So that is very tricky. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. That's Rashi in this week's Parsha. Anyone does Shnei Mikra? It says there are five times in the Torah where the Torah says, V'yareisim elokecha. Two of them appeared in Parshas Kedoshim, three of them appear in this week's Parsha. Rabbi Aaron Levine, of blessed memory, used to write up that these are all cases where it's totally bedas, meaning that it says, for example, that lifne ivir osite mirshal. You're not to give bad advice. Now, you can never convict someone of giving bad advice. The guy could always say, but I thought it was good advice. How can you prove that I knew it was bad advice? That's why it says, V'yareisim elokecha. Right, this is Krasha. It says, "Losir the Bobafarach." You can't have an Eved Ivri do Malacha Sheino Tzriyah just to show that I'm the boss. So you're going to do this work. How are you ever going to prove that I didn't really need it? Maybe I thought I needed it. So there it says, "V'erasim Malakecha." So also by ribbis, and this is part, he says we erase him elokecha. What's we erase him elokecha? He says he shouldn't be tolem ma'osa benachri. He shouldn't say, oh, this really isn't my money, it's the guy's money, etc. in order to do that. So, what?
Stan Watson.
Right.
It's not his own money. It's
just the question, you know. Right, he's the ribbis guy here. Right? We have Shabbos guys. We sell them the chametz, we sell them the Shabbos, we sell them Shemitah. Now they can buy the ribbis also. Right? This is to make everything all better through that. So again, these are a lot of times things get very complex as to who's the borrower, who's the lender. As we said, the case with the son-in-law and the father-in-law, right? When it would seem to be clear that the father-in-law is just doing a favor, but legally, no. Legally, the son-in-law is paying off the father-in-law's debts. Probably with the father-in-law's money also. to add insult to injury. Right, so these are just some of the issues of ribbis. There's a lot to be said on it in the Shulchan Aruch. If anyone decides to go for Yadin Yadin, every so often they spend a year on it. Everyone should try to learn it and be aware of the issues. And if you come into a problem, try to turn to somebody who knows a little better to deal with it. We done mincha now.
Prices for cash and credit.
So yes, there's additional cost.
So that's what you're asking.